power frequency rate in Japan. It actually has to do with television and the development of these self-flywheeling oscillators to not actually have to reference the vertical from the power line that they used to in the old days. And then eventually they made these really short duration horizontal oscillators that actually counted down and derived the vertical from. That's why we knew that one third of Japan, northern part of Japan, Tokyo and north, is 60 hertz and everything south is 50 hertz. KQRW, K2J.
Back in the days of analog television, people that have 50 hertz power, in order not to get sound bars walking across that picture, instead of having 60 fields per second, they have 50 fields per second. Instead of our 60 fields per second is 30 frames per second of our analog television. They have 25 frames per second. I know that the first time I was in England and I looked at their television set, at first it was flickering. After watching it for half an hour, my brain readjusted. I no longer saw the flicker unless I looked at the television by peripheral vision, and I saw the flicker again. So they live with a flickery television, which the brain eventually wipes it out. I bet you've seen that effect, Eric, since you're so heavily involved in television. KE2EJ, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, don't forget, we distribute stuff that goes to satellite and goes to your coast Asia. So we get to see what's called PAL, which is 50 hertz, actually 25 frames a second. It drives me up a wall. It's worse when you're watching it here because you've got a fluorescent light that's flickering at 60. It makes you a little silly. Actually, when you go to Europe, the fluorescent lights look like they're flickering. So, you know, it's what you're used to. I mean, they don't see it. But if you really want to see it, you look at a white field. Look at the center of a white field on a CRT. You get out plasma displays or LCD, you don't see it there. You'll actually see the center of the CRT appears to be brighter than the rest of it. KQRIW, K2EJ.
Fluorescent lights that are in the subway system in New York City, are they fed with DC or AC? And is it 25 hertz? There's something funny about the fluorescent lights in New York City. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
That's an interesting question, Dick. I don't think I can provide an answer to that. I do know that when they work on the tracks, in the olden days, because they replaced them, you would see a bar with five or six light bulbs on them hooked up series, hooked up to the third rail, but don't forget that was like 600 volts each day. I don't know what they distribute. You'd have to ask someone who's aware of it. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Make service to the fluorescent.
Okay, Mr. CDL, Andy, might be able to tell us about I vaguely remember him giving me some funny information with reference to the fluorescent lights that are on the platforms in New York City subway. I vaguely remember they're running on 25 hertz. Vito, were you giving me some information on that one? Back to you, Vito.
Oh, they're fed from Con Edison with two services, over.
Okay, they're fed by Con Edison. Are the fluorescent lights on the platforms in New York City subways? What's the frequency? Are those fluorescent lights running on DC? I doubt it. I think they're running on AC, but maybe it's 50 hertz or some other crazy frequency. Vito, you got it, K2RIW.
Not Vito, this is Ed. I think we sound alike. The fluorescent lights that were installed after they took out the incandescent lighting are fed from two Con Ed services. The reason for that, if they lose one service, there's an automatic ASCO switch that takes it to another service. The original lights were five bulbs in series and fed off track. Over.
KD2HUC with a comment.
Okay, Steve recognized, but they were five bulbs in series then. Are they five bulbs in series now? Back to you on that one, Ed.
The stations don't have any incandescent. they switched over it must have been the 60s and 70s to fluorescent lighting right at the edge of the track, over.
How are those fluorescent lights wired in the New York City subway today? Back to you, Ed.
It's been a couple of years since I worked for the subway, but I would assume they use the same system of two Con Ed services for reliability with an automatic ASCO switch. If they lost one service, it automatically went to the other service. Over.
Okay, Steve is next. KD2HUC, wait for the beep, and you got it, Steve.
Hey, KD2HUC. Dick, if those lights are fed from Con Edison, then they're 60 cycle. The deal with Con Edison that the MTA had to generate alternate frequencies expired in 1997. It was a 40-year deal. After 1997, they stopped generating the special frequencies for the railroads and for transit. So if they're fed from Con Ed, they're 60 cycle. KD2HUC, back to net.
Okay then, Steve. Before 1997, special frequencies. What was that special frequency and why? Was it some kind of a tradition from the 1900 days? Over to you, Steve.
The original frequency that they provided was 25 hertz. It has something to do with back in the day when most customers still had DC equipment and they first started implementing AC, they were using rotary converters. The transit systems were already using them, but they were also using them for local house power to neighborhoods. So they would use high voltage AC and then step it down, put it through a rotary converter, and provide DC to houses, you know, that were still on DC systems. For some reason, they found that 25 hertz was very efficient. It was very easy and efficient to build rotary converters for 25 hertz. Let me let it drop. Since then, the 25 hertz has been somewhat abandoned. Now they use 100 hertz and 91 and two-thirds hertz in certain areas. KD2HUC, back to net.
Boy, that immediately makes me ask two questions. In the case of 25 hertz, an incandescent bulb has got quite a bit of flywheel action to it. But I'll bet you an incandescent bulb with 25 hertz, you might see a little bit of flicker. And 91 and a third hertz or something like that, what in the world is the reason for that? Is that running some kind of a rotary machinery that has to run at a particular rate and nobody wanted to put a gear in there? Why the 91 hertz? Over to you, Steve.
Alright, let me see if I can address these backwards. The 91 and two-thirds is used in a location where they still use 25 hertz for traction power. You don't want certain relays to be able to pick, certain phase relays to pick on the presence of traction power. You want fail-safe circuitry, so on and so forth. So they use control circuits that operate on 91 and two-thirds because they're pretty certain that you're not going to get a foreign source of power out there that's going to be running that frequency that may inadvertently pick relays of critical equipment. Does that make sense?
CQT recognized. Yes, it does. The traction power, which is something like 600 or 800 volts, I used to think that was DC. Maybe it's three-phase pulsating DC. I don't think it's AC, but what is the real traction power for the New York City subway? And is it different than Long Island Railroad? Back to you on that one, Steve. K2IW.
Alright, the area in question that I'm talking about, you know what, I didn't hear the beep, let me let it drop. The area I'm talking about, that location utilizes catenary, high voltage, It's DC single phase, 11 kV, 25 hertz. It's legacy. It is what it is. The Bay Rail, on transit, I think it's still 600. On the railroad, it's 750 DC. Bay Rail is always DC, at least, you know, in our area. KD2HUC.
Okay, we've got Howie and CQT in that order. Howie, WB2HWW, K2RW. Go ahead, Howie.
Okay, just two comments. First comment is, unfortunately, at Pratt, in the last two or three years, they took out that generator. That was always a beautiful place to go to take a look. When you had nothing else to do, you walk right across from engineering. Obviously, you did that a million times like I did. And the second comment is this, that if you're in a gas station, if you look at the National Electric Code, you must use a delta wherever you have fuel. A delta is a lot safer than using a Y because you don't have that ground. That's all, but the first comment is, Dick, that generator's no longer there. And they got rid of the guy that used to maintain it. I think he was 80 years old when he retired.
Yeah, in the old days, the so-called architecture building, architecture and art building, the basement of that building had a cafeteria. You walked out of the cafeteria and you started walking toward the engineering building, and on the left-hand side you had this machine shop, so to speak, with these three huge rotary machines making the DC voltage that run that facility. Maybe there was four of them. So they stopped using the DC, and are you telling me they completely removed all of that beautiful machinery? There was an IEEE meeting in which you went on a tour, and they showed you that beautiful machinery with those great big shiny flywheels on them. Back to you for some of that information now, Howie. WB2HWW. And me with the nostalgia. K2RW, go ahead, Howie.
As far as I know, Dick, as far as I know, they took it all out. The school is now more into art than anything else. And that's basically what's going on. A lot of people upset about it, but hey, that's the way it is. I haven't been to that school in about 10 years to come back to visit, but when I speak to friends that I know of professors, they tell me that they took that all out. It's all a memory, Dick.
Yeah, that machine shop was below grade. You had to, if you wanted to walk down to the machinery, you had to walk down a set of stairs. It was a half cellar-like thing. If they took out that machinery, boy, it would be hard to use that facility for something else. Do you see it the same way I do, Howie?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I've been down there. Oh, yes. But you have to realize, if you know where the generator room was, where they had, it was all painted red, and you can see the meters? That's all gone, Dick. That, you know, they took that all out. They're not maintaining that. I can't give you any more information, but in the last 5 to 10 years, that's all gone, and a lot of people are upset about it because of a lot of memories.
Yeah, one last question on this one, Howie. The school, all of the paperwork we used to get from the school and the book covers said that Pratt Institute founded, I think it was 1887. I'm guessing that machinery goes back probably before 1900, that DC machinery. Got a guess on that one, Howie? When it was there, K2RW?
I would say it goes back to the 1900s, probably around World War I. I don't know, Dick. You're asking me questions. I can ask somebody if you want me to find out. I could speak to Professor Levitt, who I speak to. He's in his 80s, and we talk a lot. Good friend. We go out to dinner once in a while. So the next time I speak to him, I will ask him that question, and I'll either email you or come on the repeater. But you're asking me questions that I really don't know about. All I do know, that was an amazing place to go down there and see that machinery. And a lot of people got trained. And you know what? I think the founders of that school would be very upset. Because you know that not Armstrong, but the guy that was the founder of RCA took a couple of courses at that school. I don't know if you know that, that the guy that founded RCA, now Sarnoff. You know that Sarnoff went to Pratt and took a couple of night courses? There's a lot of history at that school.
Yeah, that's new information for me. That Sarnoff went there. Amazing. Okay, Herman's next up. KB2, Charlie Quebec Tango, if I got you correct, Herman. K2RIW, go ahead.
No, it's not correct. It's Larry, WB2CQT. The fellow a few minutes ago was correct. The Pennsylvania Railroad, starting in the 1930s, the overhead catenary system, 11,000 volts, 25 cycle, and it's still pretty much the way between New York and Washington today under Amtrak. Go over the rotate pitch. You switch to 60 cycle, it's about 12,000 volts. So it's still in use. And the new locomotives switch automatically. Some of the older ones we had to switch manually when we get through the phase break. And the very old locomotives couldn't be used on 60 cycles, and they're not around anymore. And I'll just be listening.
So one more time, Larry. Unfortunately, I missed some of your words. It was my fault. So when it comes to traction power for locomotives, electric-powered Long Island Railroad, or electric-powered subways, are they running on 600 or 800 volts? Is it pulsating DC, three-phase? Is it AC? What's the real voltage that's giving them traction power? WB2CQT, K2RIW.
Well, I was talking about Amtrak, the former Pennsylvania Railroad, Penn Central, Conrail. That's an overhead catenary system, which was 11,025 cycles. The subways, as far as I know, is in the 600 volt range, direct current. And the Long Island Railroad is a similar third rail system, probably in the 600 or 700 volt. As far as I know, it's pure DC. Now, the Amtrak locomotives have a converter on them that supply 480 volts three-phase for the car, for the lighting, heating, and air conditioning. And that's about how it is today.
Very fine. Thank you, Larry. The next person who signed in was Doug. We kept him waiting an awful long time. W2SAY, you're using a better antenna or whatever. You were nice and loud. I wonder if you're coming in on Eastern input. And go right ahead with your question, Doug. W2SAY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2EO, Dick. I woke up late. Can you put me at the end, please?
Yes, early.
Roger, Dodger. Go ahead, Doug.
Barry, catch you later, Barry. WA2SAY. Good evening, Dick. I have a ham radio question for a change. Talking about an off-center effect.
Oh, Barry.
Basically a diver.
Is that you, Barry? Go ahead, Barry.
Third of this length. Two questions.
Barry.
First question is, does it, if you run the slope where one end is like at 60 feet and the other end is maybe at 15 feet, does it matter whether the feed line is at the top end or at the bottom end, a third of the way from the end of the antenna? And the second question is, according to the antenna book, this thing operates on even of the fundamental frequency. So if you had an 80 meter antenna, it would operate on 40, and it would operate on 20. I mean, if you had, yeah, and if it would operate on 10. Now, the question that follows that is they're selling an antenna for a ridiculous price. It's supposed to operate 20, 10, and 6 meters. And I wonder how they do that 6 meters. So there's W-A-2-S-A-Y, back to net.
Use the alternate, Dick.
I'm relatively sure, Doug, that you're using the eastern input, because you sound so much better on the eastern input. In the case of a dipole, that's, let's say, slanted so that one end is closer to the ground, and a lot of guys will lose a lot of sleep about that, and there's nothing magic about the dipole being thoroughly balanced. I mean, the dipole would be completely unbalanced if it was a purely vertical half-wave dipole. One end is very close to the ground, the other end is very far from the ground. And as you start tilting that dipole, it doesn't give a darn. The dipole itself, as long as you're giving RF energy into it, and as long as you're resonating the system by some means, either the wire and its electrical components has got the right length, or you got the right kind of an antenna tuner. And therefore, you can also feed the dipole center, one-third from center, one end. As long as you got the right kind of balancing device, you can feed the dipole any way you want. And an extremely efficient way, let me drop. An extremely efficient way to feed the dipole would be to feed the outer end and run it as a vertical, full half-wave dipole, a very efficient way of feeding it. You need very little ground plane radials when you do it that way. The counterpoise is feeding a 10,000 ohm impedance, and so a simple stake in the ground is more than enough for a counterpoise. But you got to have some kind of an impedance matching device, because almost no antenna tuner has enough range to feed the outer end of a dipole. But a simple L network, an inductor and a capacitor as a step up, will do that beautifully. So don't worry about the dipole. Now let me drop. When it comes to a company making an antenna that works on a zillion frequencies at once, there's a lot of different ways they can do that. Let me think about that. Yeah. You can put all kinds of parallel wires and coils and inductors and capacitors and whatever. There's a zillion ways you can do it. So is there any one way better than another? It almost doesn't matter. As long as on each one of the frequencies, electronically you bring it into resonance, the wire plus the impedance matching device and or antenna tuner, as long as on each one of those frequencies you can create a resonance, and you can have extremely high efficiency on every one of those frequencies. And there's a zillion ways, if you make a complicated system, that you can make it resonate on as many frequencies as you want. The elegant way to do it would be to start off with an extremely broad piece of metal, but on each of the frequencies, that's not practical. Maybe this helps, Doug, and you've probably got some more questions on all of the above. W-A-2-S-A-Y, K-2-L-I-W.
Hey, Dick. I get the impression that this is a single wire. You've broken at the one-third point. I could be wrong. I don't know. But they have a big monster-looking ballon in the picture. I'm looking at the DX catalog, and it's a Buckmaster design. I guess the buck in Buckmaster has to do with the money that's charged for this damn thing. A 300-watt unit is $225.95. I was thinking about building one of these things for, you know, like a tenth of that. Anyway, so if it's a single wire and it's fed at one-third of the length, which it doesn't say here, it's fed at one-third, but it's an off-center fed is what it says. I wonder if there's a way that you, and it is working on the even harmonics, 40, 20, 10, and then 6 meters, which is not an even harmonic. So I don't know how they do that, which is my question. I would like to have something that would still work on 6.
If I was using an N-fed ZEP antenna, a great big long piece of wire dropping down from the back end of my dirigible, my Zeppelin, as long as I've got the right kind of an antenna tuner, I can feed it every single frequency in the world. Everything from, let me pick a number, 100 kc up to 100 megacycles. It's just a matter of creating electronic resonance. One simple piece of wire. You decide where you want to feed that piece of wire. That just makes a difference in the impedance.
with one slight exception, and that is a particular length of wire. When it's operating on your particular frequency, maybe when it's on 6 meters, if the point where you decided to tap into that wire happens to be one of the resonant node points, where at resonance there's no voltage there, life would get difficult. But with that exception, as long as you've got the right kind of an antenna tuner-like device, which forces it to be electronically resonant on each one of those frequencies, then it's going to work like a charm. So as long as you're willing to make a complicated enough antenna tuning network, it's possible to make something that that looks like a triplexer or a quadruplexer, if you know what I mean, where it's got a 6 meter input and a 10 meter input and a 15 meter input and so on. And that LC network gives you the right impedance match to electronically resonate your one piece of wire on every one of those frequencies. So instead of making a complicated piece of wire, you make a complicated antenna tuner-like network, a quadruplexer-like network. You only need electronic resonance in order to get full performance out of that piece of wire. And the exact length of the wire, even if it's a small fraction of a wavelength, the infinitesimal dipole can still give you 97% efficiency.
Repeater, timeout.
It can still give you 90% efficiency when it radiates. So an infinitesimal dipole, as long as you can force electronic resonance with your LC network, you've got it made, Doug. Ain't that crazy? Everybody thinks the wire itself has to be resonant. Absolutely not true. That's much too restrictive in your thinking. WA2SAY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Still up there to make trap dipole.
Yeah, you can put all kinds of doodads on the wire itself. You can electronically make it look longer by putting loading coils and conical wiring, helical wiring and top hat capacitors and zigzagging it and bending it up and down and whatever. That's your choice. And you change the antenna pattern a little bit when you do that. But if the network feeding your wire forces the system to be electronically resonant, it'll radiate like a charm, as long as you're using low-loss materials. The B2SAY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
B2SAY. Yeah, I realize that, but the... I did have a comment that you had brought up last week, I guess, and you had mentioned it again tonight about feeding an end of the wire, which is at $10,000 or some ridiculous number like that. The antenna matching device will be running at an operating Q of, a couple of hundred or something like that, which would give you like a bandwidth of maybe 10 kc, maybe 200 cycles, I don't know. Not very. I guess the main thing that you mentioned, let me drop it a second.
What you just said is not true, Doug. The fact that you're feeding the end of the wire versus the feeding the center of the wire, that in itself does not change the Q of the network. The wire's got the exact same Q when you feed the end versus feeding the center. However, depending on the LC ratio of your impedance step-up, yes, your impedance step-up device could drastically increase the Q of the network. Would it be a very big L and a very small C, or the other way around? Yes. If you chose a very big L and a very small C, you might end up with a very high Q. There are ways of making that network where the Q increase because of the network is not huge. A little bit of Q increase, yes. You got more stuff. One of the definitions, there's five or six definitions of Q. Energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. Well, let me drop. You got energy going into the wire, and you got energy going into your LC network. So you got more stuff with energy, therefore the Q will increase. But if you choose the right values of that network, and by the way, it doesn't have to be an LC network. It could be a step-up transformer, in which case you could probably do it with essentially no resonance in the step-up transformer therefore no change in Q at all. So the fact that you're feeding the outside end of a half-wave radiator doesn't have to give you a huge Q. The B2SAY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I will buy that if you wanted to wind a thousand turns around a toroid, you could probably do that. All right. Anyway, I thought it would be interesting to. I'm glad you really answered the question about whether the feed point is closer to the ground or closer to the elevated end, and apparently it doesn't really make any difference. So that was really the main question: how they do it, how is it? I to work 40, 20, 10, and 6. That's still an open question. I don't know how they did that. Looks to me like there's no tuning in this device at all except for the ballot. WA2SAY, back to that. And thank you, Dick.
Thank you, Brian. Yeah, somebody wants to ask another question. When I said 10,000 ohms, the outer end of a half-wave piece of wire is much closer to 5,000 ohms. 5,000 ohms versus the 50 ohms of your transmitter is a 10-to-1 ratio in impedance. As a transformer, because impedance is a function of turns squared, there's only a 3-to-1 ratio of the turns, primary versus secondary. So it's not 10,000 turns to that secondary winding. A 3-to-1, 3.5-to-1 turns ratio will step 50 ohms up to 5,000 ohms. So if you did it with a toroid transformer, don't let that scare you. The B2SAY, K2LAW in the TechNet.
50 to 5,000 is something like 100 times, not 10.
You're right. I slipped the decimal place. It's a 100-to-1 impedance ratio, which means it's a 10-to-1 turns ratio. In theory, if you've got a big enough toroid, a couple of turns on the primary and 10 times as many turns on the secondary. That's not 10,000 turns, Doug. The B2SAY, K2IW.
Okay. Okay, I don't think I'm going to feed anything at the bottom end. That's, well, I guess I could. I think about that. What I really need is a spectrum analyzer. Not a spectrum analyzer, but a network analyzer. And then I can figure out what's really going on. But I don't have to wire up yet, so I just trying to figure out what's the best thing to do. I think I'll wind that up now and turn it back to Ned.
Distance on
that. WA2SAY will say goodnight, and I'll be listening out.
Yeah, Doug, in your case where you've got a complicated piece of property, where the dipole itself is going to be slanted, one end is up in the tree and the other end is close to the ground, the end that's close to the ground is easiest to feed. To try to get a transmission line up there halfway between the ends of that dipole, that represents a physical problem. If you're smart enough to feed the lower end of a half-wavelength long piece of wire, and the end that's closer to the ground is the end that you're feeding, and you use the right kind of an impedance step-up device, whether it be a toroid transformer or an LC network, is your choice. That gives you the least amount of feeding problems, the most amount of performance. You don't need a great big set of ground plane radials. And by the way, that piece of wire, you can have a number of pieces of wire branching out from that ground, where some of them are resonant on the first and second harmonic, and some of them are on the crazy frequency, like 6 meters. So if you're willing to branch a couple of pieces of wire from that ground connection, and some of them are longer than the others, you can get all the bands that you want. And end feeding all of these HF bands could be very efficient. So without spending a whole lot of bucks, you got more choices here than you know about. Somebody wants to make a comment on all of the above. Give me your identification first. The call that is a name. K2IW in the TechNet.
K2GJE, Ed.
You've got it, Ed.
With my butt, I'll wait. Sounds like the antenna he was describing was the old-fashioned Windham. We used to feed those with 300-ohm line because it was cheap at Lafayette Radio, but also probably would have been better with open-wire line. I had a vertical
years ago that I said was I call a transformer. Matter of fact, while you were talking...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The transmitter was fed one turn up. The bottom of the coil was ground. I have the coil, and I fed the end of the antenna up one of the taps, which are also a variable, and just watch the SWR meter, over.
Yeah, that Windham antenna was one of the first antennas fed off center, primarily with twin leader open wire lines. But people were very upset about the fact that that dipole was not being fed in the center. And there's a magic point off to one side in which with the right kind of open wire line and maybe an antenna tuner, you can make that thing work on a whole lot of different bands. So there's no magic place to feed your radiator. Because of the diagrams they see in books and all the discussions they have in the air, everybody thinks the dipole has got to be paralleled to the ground, completely out flat, no zigzags, fed in the center. All of these things are orally restricted. It's a resonating device, electronically resonating device, and like a flywheel, you can put the pushrod anywhere you want to on that flywheel and still feed energy into it. The pushrod can be close to the pivot or near the perimeter. That's your choice. You get different impedances, but they all work. There was another person who wanted to make comment who said, I'll wait. Before we get to N2EO, who is that other person? Give me a call, that is K2LAW.
Again.
Barry.
Okay.
Barry.
Each of you guys are making transmissions so brief that I hear one letter and I'm not hearing the whole thing. Squeeze the mic. Wait a second until you get picked up. Then give me your full set of call letters and name. KQLAW listening.
Get organized here, Barry. Let's not fool around. Come on, Barry. 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 Hey, Barry. Good one with you, Barry.
WB2HWW, one comment on that antenna. You can use an auto transformer. That's how you can feed an antenna from the end like an Antron.
Yeah, that's even better, Howie. You're absolutely right. You can, the 10 to 1 turns ratio doesn't even have to be 10 turns in the primary, 100 turns in the secondary. It can be anything as an auto transformer that's got a 10 to 1 turns ratio. Good point. Someone else wanted to make a comment. Who was that? Give me a call. That is a name. K2RIW.
USAY again.
Go ahead, Doug. Wait for the beeps.
The off-center fed or the end fed with twin lead. According to the antenna book, the ARRL book, which is a few years old, the one I have, is if you feed this off-center fed thing with twin lead or something like that, which would be nice because then you can resonate it down at the far end. But the problem is apparently the feed line becomes hot. In other words, it picks up the radiation off the antenna and it does nasty things to your feed line and so on. So that's what they say. You really need a ballon at the feed point.
You said what I was about to say. Use the right kind of a ballon. Use the right kind of a ballon at the feed point, and the feed line does not become hot. So you can feed it anywhere you want. With the right kind of ballon and the right kind of impedance matching device, they all can be made to work. And by the way, the feed line being hot isn't always bad. There are times when a hot feed line, as long as it's not running alongside of somebody's television set, it's just a more complicated radiator. So we shouldn't lose a whole lot of sleep out of that. Just to know that the feed line could become hot with an off-center fed, and if you don't like that, then the right kind of a balancing device will make that go away. Was there someone else who wanted to make a comment on all of the above before we go to the next person? Give me your call letters now. K2RIW and TechNet.
D2FIU.
Okay. You started talking first and then squeezed. All we got is 2FIU. But we've talked to FIU before. Go ahead, George.
Thank you, Dick. Just to sum this up, when you say in twin line, we mean 300 ohms. If we were talking open, we meant 600. And if we were talking window line, we meant 450. Just to summarize what we were talking about with balanced line within this previous conversation here, can we kind of not go into it, but was that it? And we'll let it go to the next. George, KD2FIU.
You would like the feed line on any of these systems where you're doing a lot of the impedance matching in the shack. You'd like the feed line to be very low in insertion loss. And therefore, if the feed line is running a high standing wave ratio and it's very low in loss, you get no disadvantage. You put a very high standing wave ratio into coax, you're starting to get a whole lot of loss. The low loss feed lines can be open wire line where you've got a wide spacing between the wires and it's 600 ohms. Not so much spacing between the wires and it's 450. Little less spacing between the wires and it's 300. Even less spacing between the wires back in the days of ITT's 200 ohm twin lead. I think they even made a 72 ohm twin lead. So you want the feed line to be low in insertion loss with these exotic feeding systems. And your choice as to which one of them you choose. There's nothing magic about using 600 ohm line. If you had an antenna, let me drop the phone. You had an antenna where the original design was open wire line for 600 ohms or 400 ohms, and you just happened to have a method of construction or a way you purchased twin lead like open wire line that happened to be 331 ohms of impedance. Doesn't matter. It's just a slightly different setting of your antenna tuner. So the real magic here is balancing if you don't want the line to be hot, and low insertion loss if you want a lot of impedance matching to take place in the shack and you've got a broad enough range antenna tuner. Does that make some sense, George? KD2FIU, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, this is very good, Dick, because this is helping me with my project. Not for tonight, but balances is something that I got to understand in impedance and apply to how I'm going to do what I want to do. And thank you. KD2FIU, over to you, Dick, K2RIW.
The one slight disadvantage of feeding a dipole away from the center. You decide to feed 10%, 50%, 70% from one side, is that you will have some common mode voltage on that transmission line. And if you don't want the transmission line to be hot, you're going to have to use some kind of a balancing device at the feed point at the antenna. The balancing device, in some cases, is nothing more than the RF equivalent of an isolation transformer. That's not the only way to do it, but one way to do it would be essentially an isolation transformer. Call it a toroid. Let me drop it. A toroid where the secondary winding goes to the antenna and the primary winding goes to your transmission line. Now, the real feed point of the antenna can float RF-wise any way it wants to because it's on its own secondary winding of that balancing device, which is acting like an isolation transformer. As I said, it's not the only way to make a balancing device, but in order to visualize what the balance is doing, an isolation transformer, in some people's mind, makes it a lot clearer. I wonder if that makes some sense, George. KD2FIU, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, it does. And I didn't want to go into it that deep. I wanted to get a little concept of balanced line at this point and how I could use it, understanding 600, 450, and 300, 300 being the old stuff, and 600 being the original. Thank you. KD2FIU.
The magic of open wire line is that at most of the HF frequencies, the real spacing between those wires, even in the case of 600 ohm open wire line, the spacing between those two wires is an extremely small fraction of a wavelength. And if you're feeding it with the right kind of a open wire feeding system, your antenna tuner or your impedance matching device may be a box with two porcelain insulators coming out of it that go to the two wires of the open wire line. That open wire line is an extremely well-shielded structure, even though your eye says, hey, that's open as all hell, and you think it's going to radiate like a banshee. Let me drop. As long as you're feeding in a true differential manner, in other words, if at one instant of time the right-hand wire is plus 100 volts and the left-hand wire is minus 100 volts, and a half cycle later they're reversed, as long as you've got equal voltage on the two lines, and it's an equal differential voltage with reference to ground, then at most of the HF frequencies, that is an extremely well-shielded structure. It doesn't radiate. Hard to believe. If you now start sliding toward non-differential, so-called common mode, if you put plus 100 volts on the right-hand side and plus 100 volts on the left-hand side, you're still using it as a transmission line, but now you're using it in the thorough common mode manner, and it will radiate like crazy. You think you've got a transmission line. That's just another L network as far as your, a physical L as far as your antenna is concerned. Now there's all kinds of things in between. You can slowly slide from fully differential toward common mode. In other words, let me drop. I could put plus 100 volts on the right-hand side and minus 50 volts on the left-hand side on this half cycle. I'm now halfway between fully differential and fully common mode. And certain kinds of antennas, like a great big full wavelength loop antenna parallel to the ground, as you slide from one to the other, you're changing the antenna pattern, you're changing the polarization characteristics of the antenna. Mel, K2KEY, was doing that set of experiments on his full wavelength loop antenna in, he was living in Manhattan Beach, and as he adjusted the controls on his antenna, his homebrew antenna tuner, let me drop it. He could slowly slide from fully differential, where the wire was perfectly shielded, toward common mode, and eventually go all the way over to common mode, where his transmission line is now radiated. As he did that, depending on the state of the ionosphere, the guy he's listening to in, let's say, London, would be louder in one mode and louder in another mode that particular day. So that very simple-looking transmission line plus antenna has all kinds of electronic tricks you can play with in the shack with impedance matching and choosing the way you feed that transmission line, fully differential, fully common mode, and everything in between. There's ways of steering the beam, steering the polarization when you do that. And the fact that your transmission line is doing some of the radiating when it's not fully differential, that's not necessarily bad. It's just a more complicated antenna, and you're using some of the other tricks you've got in your bag of tricks. So you may not want to do that immediately, but there's a couple of other tricks you could be using there, George. Over to you, George, and I think someone else wants to make a comment on this. George first. You got it, George. K2RAW.
Dick, this is very good because I'm still working on that phasing line thing. That's a whole different topic. I won't even bring it in here. Something we've talked in the last few weeks. But a lot to be absorbed here. Thank you very much. KD2FIU, and somebody else was trying to get in while you were talking.
Yeah, there's somebody with an extremely noisy signal. Give it another try. K2RIW in the tech net.
Oh, boy. I don't know that I have a noisy signal. And to XGM. If you could say a few words about the termination of the input impedance in open line transmission. So the transmission line input impedance. I believe some people might be confused. You have a 300 ohm flat line, that the one that was used for the TV. Then you have a big one that is quite spaced between two wires, and I believe that would help. Enter.
Okay, if the antenna on the end of my transmission line happened to be 600 ohm impedance, and let's make it 600 ohm balanced to start off simple, and I'm using 600 ohm open wire line, my input impedance is going to be 600 ohms. If with that 600 ohm transmission line, 600 ohm open wire line, if my antenna happens to be 300 ohms, that's a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio on that line, depending on the length of that transmission line, there's a bunch of different impedances I could see. If the transmission line was an exact number of half wavelengths, the magic of half wavelengths is it repeats impedance. 300 ohms on the far end, I'll see 300 ohms on the near end, even though it's 600 ohm impedance line. If it's an odd number of quarter wavelengths in length, then I get impedance inversion. 300 ohms on one end would probably be 1,200 ohms on the input end. Impedance inversion. If you got an odd number of quarter wavelengths, and if your load is low in impedance compared to the line, your input impedance will be higher than the transmission line impedance, and vice versa. So you get impedance inversion with quarter wavelength line. You get exact impedance with an even number of quarter waves, half wave, one wave, and so on. So length of line becomes important if and only if the load is not matched. The load being not matched with a very low loss line is nothing to lose sleep over. Let me explain that. If your feed line is low in loss, the fact that you've got a mismatch at the far end almost doesn't matter. You got some standing wave on that line. Big deal. As long as you've got enough range to your antenna tuner, the whole thing can become 98% efficient. So, transmission line length matters if there's an impedance mismatch at the far end. But even an impedance mismatch at the far end is not necessarily bad. There is a formula I could give you, a little bit complicated, where if you plug into the formula, what is the load impedance, and that load impedance can be partially resistive, partially reactive, that doesn't matter, and the length of the line, if you know that, and the impedance of the line, if you know that, if you got those three facts, length of line, impedance of line, and complete impedance of load, there is a formula which will tell you exactly what impedance you're going to get on the input. A Smith chart will allow you to find that answer graphically. There is a formula I could give you that allows you to give you an exact answer on your handheld calculator. So there's not too much black magic to all of this, Wes. There's a lot of deterministic characteristics here. Lots of people have worried about... Let me drop. Lots of people have worried about what impedance you're going to get. With your what input impedance you're going to see under various situations, and it's all predictable. Maybe that helps a little bit. I know that what I said takes quite a while for it to all sink in and make some sense. N2XJN, K2RIW.
I don't believe I have much problem with that. I thought that would be interesting to others. However, the input impedance is simply the line impedance since at the beginning when you have an input line. And quite interesting is that that input impedance doesn't have to be equal to the load impedance, nor to the characteristic of impedance Z0 when If I remember correctly, the formula was, let me jump.
Sounds like Leslie's Big Polish Army Festival. It's Leslie the Big Polish Animal.
KE2EJ.
Z in equals the Z minus the length. But the ZL would be, the ZL would be the load, okay, so. What do we have, important factor, is the length of the light. Now, my question is, do we always have, for the open transmission line, limit length of the line? If we decide to not use the transmit, and direction?
Yeah, stand by a little bit here, Wes. KE2EJ, Eric, are you hearing me? KE2EJ, KGYIW?
Yes, sir.
Maybe something funny is going on with my equipment, but I think I'm seeing the power output of A5 jumping up and down, and when it's in the down mode, I don't hear 375. It's either my crazy equipment, or there's really a change in the transmitter on the Glen Oaks. Which do you think it is, Eric? Go ahead.
Have you considered the possibility of another transmitter coming on at the same frequency?
I can ask Mercy.
If that's true, I wouldn't see a complete dropout of 375, unless my front end is being overloaded. Not sure what's going on here. So, you're seeing the output of 85 staying steady, is that what you're saying?
Yeah,
I am. Yeah, no, I haven't seen any change in output, but I'm going to go look at it electronically in a minute. See what it's doing.
Five. Yeah, I'm hearing 85 go down in power, and I'm seeing 375 go off the air periodically. And so either I'm getting a failure, or it's really happening. Let me try to reset my machine here. No?
Listen to this, Dick. You said 375 is not on the air, and you're seeing something on 85 that's less power than what you normally see. Now, if 375 is not on the air, chances are 85 is not on the air, and you're seeing it at a transmitter.
I'm watching on in power. When 85 is up in power, 375 is on the air. When 85 is down in power, 375 is off the air. That's what I'm seeing. It's possible I'm getting front end overload that makes me see that, and maybe it's not real. But if you saw 375 not on the air, then you're getting a partial confirmation. Over to you, Eric, KTRIW.
All right, hang on. Let me turn the darn stuff off for a second. There has been a, let's call it a rogue transmitter, that has been operating on 85. And usually when the carrier of 85 drops, this rogue transmitter is there. Could you possibly consider that is what you're seeing, because that's been happening for quite a while now?
I know about the rogue transmitter. And the rogue transmitter at my QGH is very low in power compared to 85. So I'm not getting overload from that rogue transmitter. But tonight I'm seeing 85 in the last 10 minutes jump up and down in power. When it's down in power, 375 is off the air. How is the audio getting to 375? Is it coming from 85? That I didn't know. KE2EJ, KQLIW.
I wanted to let it drop completely. Okay. Give you a quick overview on how the things are linked together. The signal comes into the 85 receiver when it comes in on 25. It in turn goes through a controller, a device which will send audio and push to talk several places. All at the same time, it'll send a push-to-talk and audio to the 85 transmitter. We'll also send a push-to-talk and audio to a link frequency transmitter. Now, the receive side of that link frequency transmitter will then feed a push-to-talk into the controller at that end and the audio, and it will feed that into the 375 transmitter. With me so far?
Yes, I am. Under normal circumstances, I can hear you on my input.